They evidently produced a strong impression on you. Why, of course, I always write them down. Well, Kitty, have you been skating again? She began to talk with Kitty. Awkward as it would have been for Levin to leave just then, he would have preferred doing so to remaining in the house for the rest of the evening in sight of Kitty, who now and then glanced at him but avoided catching his eye. He was about to rise when the princess, noticing his silence, turned toward him and said, "Have you come to Moscow for long? But I believe you are on the Zemstvo and cannot stay away long." "No, princess, I am no longer on the Zemstvo," he answered. "I have come to Moscow for a few days." Something out of the common has happened to him, thought the Countess Nordston, scrutinizing his stern and serious face. Why does he not start on one of his discourses? But I'll draw him out. I do love to make a fool of him when Kitty's about, and I will. "Mr. Levin," she began, "explain to me, please, you who know everything, how it is that at our Kaluga estate the peasant men and women have drunk everything they had and never pay anything they owe us. What is the explanation? You always praise the peasants so much." At that moment another lady entered the room, and Levin rose. "Excuse me, Countess, but really I know nothing about it and can't tell you anything," he said. And as he turned, he saw an officer who had come into the room behind the lady. "That must be Vronsky," he thought, and looked at Kitty to make sure. She had already glanced at Vronsky and then turned toward Levin. And by the look of her eyes, which had involuntarily brightened, Levin realized that she loved this man, realized it as surely as if she had told it him in so many words. But what kind of man was he? Now, rightly or wrongly, Levin could not but remain. He had to find out what sort of a man it was that she loved. There are people who, when they meet a rival, no matter in what, at once shut their eyes to everything good in him and see only the bad. There are others who, on the contrary, try to discern in a lucky rival the qualities which have enabled him to succeed, and with aching hearts seek only the good in him. Levin belonged to the latter sort. But it was not difficult for him to see what was good and attractive in Vronsky. It struck him immediately. Vronsky was a dark, sturdily built man of medium height, with a good-natured, handsome, exceedingly quiet and firm face. Everything about his face and figure, from his black, closely cropped hair and freshly shaven chin to his wide, brand-new uniform, was simple and at the same time elegant. Having stepped aside to let a lady pass, Vronsky approached first the princess and then Kitty. When he moved toward her, his fine eyes brightened with a special tenderness, and carefully and respectfully bending over her with a scarcely perceptible, happy, and, as it seemed to Levin, modestly triumphant smile, he held out to her his small, broad hand. Having greeted and spoken a few words to everyone else, he sat down without having once looked at Levin, who had not taken his eyes off him. "Let me introduce you," said the princess, indicating Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrich Levin, Count Alexis Kirillovich Vronsky." Vronsky rose and, looking cordially into Levin's eyes, pressed his hand. "I was to have dined with you earlier this winter," he said with his simple, frank smile, "but you unexpectedly went away to the country."
"Mr. Levin despises and hates the town and us townspeople," said Countess Nordston.
"My words must make a deep impression on you for you to remember them so long," said Levin. Then, recollecting that he had said this before, he blushed. Vronsky glanced at him and at the Countess and smiled. "And you always live in the country?" he asked. "Isn't it dull in the winter?" "No, not when one is busy. Nor need one be dull in one's own company," replied Levin abruptly. "I'm fond of the country," said Vronsky, noticing but pretending not to notice Levin's tone.
"But I hope, Count, you would not consent always to live in the country," said the Countess Nordston.
"I don't know. I've never tried it for long. I have experienced a curious feeling," he went on. "Nowhere have I felt so homesick for the country, our Russian country, with its peasants in bark shoes, as when I spent a winter with my mother in Nice. Nice in itself is dull, you know. And Naples and Sorrento are pleasant only for a short stay, and it is there that one thinks of Russia and longs, especially for the Russian countryside. They seem to..."
He was addressing both Kitty and Levin, his quiet and friendly glance passing from the one to the other. He was evidently speaking quite sincerely and frankly. Noticing that the Countess Nordston wished to say something, he stopped without finishing what he was saying and listened attentively to her. The conversation did not flag for a moment, so that the old princess, who always had in reserve, in case of need, two heavy guns, classical versus modern education and general conscription, had no need to bring them forward, and the Countess Nordston had no opportunity to tease Levin. Levin wished to join in the general conversation, but found it impossible, and kept saying to himself, "Now I will go." Yet he did not go, but waited for something indefinite. The conversation touched on table-turning and spiritualism, and the Countess Nordston, who believed in spiritualism, began relating miracles she had witnessed.
"Ah, Countess, you must really take me there. For goodness sake, take me to them. I have never seen anything supernatural, though I always look out for it," said Vronsky, smiling.
"Very well, next Saturday," replied the Countess Nordston. "And you, Mr. Levin? Do you believe in it?" she asked, turning to him.
"Why do you ask me? You know very well what I shall say."
"But I want to hear your opinion."
"My opinion is that this table-turning proves that our so-called educated class is on the same level as the peasants. They believe in the evil eye and spells and witchcraft, while we..."
"Well, then, you don't believe."
"I can't believe, Countess."
"But if I have seen it myself..."
"The peasant women tell how they've seen the goblins with their own eyes."
"Then you think I am not telling the truth?" And she laughed mirthlessly.
"Oh, no, Masha, Mr. Levin only says he can't believe," said Kitty, blushing for Levin. And Levin, understanding this, became still more irritated and wished to answer. But Vronsky, with his bright and frank smile, came at once to the rescue of the conversation, which was threatening to become unpleasant.
"You don't admit that it is even possible?" he asked.
"But why not? We admit the existence of electricity, which we don't understand. Why can't there be other forces which we do not yet know, but which..."
"When electricity was first discovered," Levin hurriedly interrupted, "only the phenomena were observed. Their cause and its effects were unknown. Centuries passed before anyone thought of applying it. But the spiritualists, on the contrary, began by the tables writing for them and the spirits coming to them, and they only afterwards began to say that it was an unknown force."
Vronsky listened attentively to Levin, as he always listened, evidently interested in what he was saying.
"Yes, but the spiritualists say, 'We do not yet know what force it is, but it exists, and these are the conditions under which it acts. Or let the scientists discover what the force is.' No, I do not see why it should not be a new force if it..."
"For this reason," Levin again interrupted him, "that with electricity you need only rub a piece of resin against wool, and you will always produce a certain phenomenon, but this other does not always act, so it is not a natural force." Probably feeling that the conversation was becoming too serious for a drawing room, Vronsky did not reply. But in order to change the subject, he smiled gaily and turned toward the ladies.
"Let us try now, Countess," he began.
But Levin wanted to finish saying what he thought.
"I think," he continued, "that this attempt of the spiritualists to explain their wonders by some kind of new force is most unsuccessful. They speak definitely of a spiritual force, and yet want to subject it to a material test."
Everybody waited for him to finish, and he was conscious of it.
"I think you would make a splendid medium," said the Countess Nordston. "There is something ecstatic about you."
Levin opened his mouth to reply, but blushed and said nothing.
"Let us try table-turning now, Princess Kitty. Please do," said Vronsky. "May we, Princess?" he said to her mother, and he rose and looked round for a suitable table. Kitty rose to fetch a table, and as she passed Levin, their eyes met. She pitied him with her whole soul, especially because she herself had caused him to suffer.
"If you can forgive me, please do," pleaded her look. "I am so happy."
"I hate everybody, including you and myself," answered his eyes, and he took up his hat.
But he was not fated to go yet. Just as the others began settling round the table and Levin was about to go, the old prince came in, and having greeted the ladies, he turned to Levin.
"Ah!" said he, heartily. "Been here long? I did not even know that you had arrived. Very glad to see you."
He embraced Levin, and speaking to him, did not catch sight of Vronsky, who rose and stood quietly waiting until the prince should notice him. Kitty was conscious that, after what had taken place, her father's cordiality oppressed Levin. She also noticed how coldly her father at last responded to Vronsky's bow, and with what good-natured perplexity Vronsky looked at him, trying but failing to understand how it was possible not to be friendly disposed toward him, and she blushed.
"Prince, release Mr. Levin for us, as we want to try an experiment," said the Countess Nordston.
"What experiment? Table-turning? Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, but in my opinion playing at Hunt the Ring is more amusing," said the old prince, looking at Vronsky and guessing that he had started the thing. "After all, there is some sense in hunting the ring."
Vronsky's unflinching eye glanced in astonishment at the old prince, and slightly smiling, he at once began talking to the Countess Nordston about the ball that was to take place the next week.
"I hope you will be there," he said to Kitty.
As soon as the old prince had turned away from him, Levin went out unobserved, and his last impression was Kitty's happy, smiling face as she answered Vronsky's question about the ball.
Chapter 15. After the guests had gone, Kitty told her mother of her conversation with Levin, and in spite of all her pity for him, she was pleased by the thought that she had had a proposal. She did not doubt that she had acted rightly, yet for a long time she lay in bed, unable to sleep. One image pursued her relentlessly. It was Levin's face with his kind eyes looking mournfully from under his knit brows as he stood listening to her father and glancing at her and at Vronsky, and she felt so sorry for him that tears rose to her eyes. But she immediately remembered for whom she had exchanged him. She vividly pictured to herself that strong, manly face, that well-bred calm, and the kindness toward everybody he always showed. She remembered the love the man she loved bore her, and again became joyful, and with a happy smile put her head on her pillow. "It is a pity, but I'm not to blame," she said to herself. But an inner voice said something different. Whether she repented of having drawn Levin on or of having rejected him, she did not know, but her happiness was troubled by doubts.
"Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy," she repeated to herself till she fell asleep.
Meanwhile, below in the prince's little study, her parents were having one of their frequent scenes about their favourite daughter.
"What? I'll tell you what!"
shouted the prince, flourishing his arms and immediately again wrapping his squirrel-lined dressing-gown around him.
"You have no pride, no dignity. You disgrace and ruin your daughter by this vile, idiotic matchmaking."
"For goodness sake, prince, what in heaven's own name have I done?" said the princess, almost in tears.
After her talk with her daughter, she had come in, happy and contented, to say good night to the prince, as usual, and though she did not intend to speak to him about Levin's proposal and Kitty's refusal, She hinted to him that she thought the matter with Vronsky was quite settled and would probably be definitely decided as soon as his mother arrived. And when she said that, the prince suddenly flared up and began to shout rudely,
"What have you done? Why, this! First of all, you entice a suitor. All Moscow will talk about it, and with reason. If you give a party, invite everybody, and not only selected suitors, invite all the young puppies," so the prince called the Moscow young men. "Have a pianist and let them dance. But don't have the sort of thing we had tonight. These suitors and this pairing off. It makes me sick to see it, simply sick. And you've had your way and have turned the child's head. Lievin is 1,000 times the better man. This one is a little Petersburg fop. They are machine-made by the dozen, all to one pattern, and all mere rubbish. But even if he were a prince of the blood, my daughter does not need him."
"But what have I done?"
"Just this," exclaimed the prince angrily.
"I know this much," the princess interrupted him,
"that if I were to listen to what you say, we should never see our daughter married, and we'd better go and live in the country." "So we had."
"Wait a bit. Do I draw them on?" "No, certainly not. But a young man, and an excellent young man, falls in love with Kitty, and she too seems..."
"Seems indeed. And suppose she really falls in love with him while he intends to marry about as much as I do? Oh, I wish my eyes had never seen it. Ah, spiritualism. Ah, how nice. Ah, the ball."
And the prince, imagining himself to be impersonating his wife, curtsied at each word.
"And then, if we really ruin Kitty's happiness, if she really gets it into her head..."
"But why do you suppose such a thing?"
"I don't suppose, I know. We have eyes for those things, and women haven't. I can recognize a man who has serious intentions, such as Lievin, and I can see through a weathercock like that popinjay, who only wishes to amuse himself.
Oh, well, when you once get a thing into your head..."
"And you'll find it out, but too late, just as with poor Dolly."
All right, don't let's talk," said the princess, interrupting him and remembering the unfortunate Dolly.
"Very well, then. Good night."
And having made the sign of the cross over one another and kissed, feeling that each of them retained their individual opinions, the couple separated for the night. The princess had been at first firmly convinced that this evening had decided Kitty's fate, and that there could be no doubt as to Vronsky's intentions. But her husband's words disturbed her, and when she reached her room, in terror of the uncertainty of the future, she mentally repeated, just as Kitty had done, "Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy." Chapter 16. Vronsky had never known family life. His mother in her youth had been a brilliant society woman, and during her married life, and especially in her widowhood, had had many love affairs known to everybody. He hardly remembered his father, and had been educated in the cadet corps. On leaving that corps, as a very young and brilliant officer, he at once joined the swim of the wealthy military Petersburg set. Though he occasionally went into the highest Petersburg society, all his love interests lay outside it. In Moscow, after this luxurious course of Petersburg life, he experienced for the first time the delight of intimacy with a sweet, innocent society girl who fell in love with him. It never entered his head that there could be any wrong in his relations with Kitty. At balls he danced chiefly with her, and he visited her at her home. He talked with her the usual society talk, all sorts of rubbish, but rubbish into which, involuntarily, he put a special meaning for her. Though he never said anything to her which could not have been said before everybody, he was conscious that she was becoming more and more dependent upon him, and the more he felt this, the pleasanter it was, and the more tender became his feelings towards her. He did not know that his behaviour toward Kitty had a name of its own, that it was decoying a girl with no intentions of marrying her, and is one of the evil actions common among brilliant young men like himself. He thought he was the first to discover this pleasure, and he enjoyed his discovery. If he could have heard what her parents said that night, if he could have known her family's point of view and learnt that Kitty would be unhappy if he did not marry her, he would have been much surprised and would not have believed it. He would not have believed that what gave so much and such excellent pleasure to him, and, what was more, to her, could be wrong. Even less could he have believed that he ought to marry. Marriage had never presented itself to him as a possibility. Not only did he dislike family life, but in accordance with the views generally held in the bachelor world in which he lived, he regarded the family, and especially a husband, as something alien, hostile, and above all, ridiculous. But although Vronsky had no suspicion of what Kitty's parents were saying, he felt, as he left the Shcherbatskys' house that night, that the secret spiritual bond which existed between him and Kitty had so strengthened during the evening that some action ought to be taken. But what this should or could be, he could not imagine. "That's what is so delightful," he thought, as he left the Shcherbatskys' house, carrying away from there, as usual, a pleasant feeling of purity and freshness, partly due to the fact that he had not smoked at all that evening, and deeply touched by a new sense of tender joy in the consciousness of her love for him. "That is what is so delightful, that nothing was said either by me or by her. Yet we so well understand one another in that subtle language of looks and tones that today, more plainly than ever, she has told me that she loves me. And how sweetly, simply, and above all, trustfully. I feel myself better and purer. I feel I have a heart and that there is much that is good in me." Those dear, loving eyes, when she said, "and very much."
"Well, and what of it?" "Nothing, of course. It's pleasant for me and for her."
And he considered where he should finish his evening. He passed in review the places he might go to.
"The club? A game of bezique, a bottle of champagne with Ignatieff? No, I won't go there. Château des Fleurs. There I should find Oblonsky. French couplets, the can-can. No, I'm sick of it. That's just what I like about the Shcherbatskys, that I myself become better there. I'll go home."
He went straight to his rooms at the Hotel Dusso, had supper, and after undressing had hardly laid his head on his pillow before he was fast asleep. Chapter 17. At 11 o'clock next morning, Vronsky drove to the Petersburg railway station in Moscow to meet his mother, and the first person he saw on the steps of the large portico was Oblonsky, who was expecting his sister by the same train.
"Hello, Your Excellency," exclaimed Oblonsky. "Whom are you after?"
"My mother,"
replied Vronsky, shaking hands and smiling, as everybody did when meeting Oblonsky, as they went up the steps together.
"She's coming from Petersburg today." "I waited for you till 2 last night. Where did you go from the Shcherbatskys?"
"Home," replied Vronsky.
"To tell you the truth, I felt in such a pleasant mood when I left the Shcherbatskys that I did not care to go anywhere else."
"Fiery steeds by something brands I can always recognize. Youths in love," declaimed Oblonsky, just as he had done to Levin.
Vronsky smiled with a look that seemed not to deny the implication, but he immediately changed the subject.
"And whom have you come to meet?" he asked.
"I? A lovely woman," answered Oblonsky.
"Dear me. On y soit qui mal y pense. My sister, Anna."
"Oh, Mrs. Karenina," said Vronsky.
"I expect you know her?"
"I think I do, but perhaps not. I really can't remember," answered Vronsky absent-mindedly, the name Karenina suggesting to him someone stiff and dull. "But you're sure to know Alexis Alexandrovich Karenin, my famous brother-in-law. All the world knows him."
"Oh, yes, I know him by repute and by sight. I know he's clever, learned, and by way of being religious, but you know it is not my... not in my line," he added in English.
"Oh, yes, he's a very remarkable man, a bit conservative, but a splendid fellow," said Oblonsky, "a splendid fellow."
"Well, so much the better for him," and Vronsky smiled.
"Ah, you're here," he went on, turning toward his mother's old footman, who was standing by the door.
Come in here. Besides liking Oblonsky, as everybody did, Vronsky latterly had felt still more drawn to him because he was connected in his mind with Kitty. "Well, are we to give a supper to the diva next Sunday?" he asked, smilingly, taking Oblonsky's arm. "Certainly. I will collect subscriptions. I say, did you make the acquaintance of my friend Lievin last night?" asked Oblonsky.
"Of course. Only he left very early."
"He's a splendid fellow," continued Oblonsky.
"Don't you think so?"
"I don't know how it is that all Muscovites, present company of course excepted," Vronsky put in jokingly, "are so abrupt. They're always standing on their hind legs, getting angry, and seem to want to act on your feelings."
"Yes, there's some truth in that," said Oblonsky, laughing merrily.
"Shall we have to wait much longer?" asked Vronsky, turning to a porter.
"The train is signalled," said the porter.
The approach of the train was made more and more evident by the increasing bustle and preparation on the platform and the arrival of people who had come to meet the train. Through the frosty mist one could see workmen in sheepskin coats and felt boots crossing the curved railway lines, and hear the whistle of a locomotive and the noisy movements of a heavy mass. "No," said Oblonsky, who was anxious to tell Vronsky about Lievin's intentions concerning Kitty.
"No, you have not judged my Lievin rightly. He is a very nervous man, and does make himself unpleasant sometimes, that's true enough, but, on the other hand, he's sometimes very charming. His is such an honest, straightforward nature, and he has a heart of gold. But yesterday there were special reasons," continued Oblonsky, with a significant smile, quite forgetting the sincere sympathy he had felt for his friend the day before, and now only feeling the same sympathy for Vronsky. "Yes, there was a reason why he had to be either specially happy or specially unhappy." Vronsky stopped and asked him straight out,
"What do you mean?
Did he propose to your belle sœur last night?"
"Perhaps," said Oblonsky. "I seemed to notice something of the kind yesterday. Oh, yes, if he left early and was in a bad temper, it must be that. He's been in love with her so long, and I'm very sorry for him."
"Dear me. But I should think she may make a better match," said Vronsky, and expanding his chest, he again moved forward. "However, I don't know him," he added.
"Yes, it is a painful position. That is why so many prefer women of the demi-monde. If you don't succeed in that case, it only shows that you've not enough money. But in this case, one's pride is in the balance. But here's the train." In fact, the engine was already whistling in the distance, and a few moments later the platform shook as the train puffed in. The steam spread low in the frozen air, the connecting rods slowly and rhythmically pushed and pulled. The bent figure of the engine driver, warmly wrapped up, was seen covered with hoarfrost. The engine, with the tender behind it, moved slowly into the station, gradually slowing down and making the platform tremble still more. Then came the luggage van in which a dog was whining, and at last the passenger coaches, oscillating before they stopped. The sprightly guard blew his whistle and jumped off while the train was still moving, and impatient passengers began to descend one after another. An officer of the guards, erect and looking sternly round, a fidgety little tradesman with a bag, a peasant with a sack over his shoulder. Vronsky, as he stood by Oblonsky and watched these passengers coming out of the carriages, quite forgot about his mother. What he had just heard about Kitty excited and delighted him. His chest involuntarily expanded and his eyes shone. He felt himself to be a conqueror.
"The Countess Vronsky is in that compartment," said the sprightly guard, addressing Vronsky.
His words roused Vronsky from his reverie and reminded him of his mother and of the coming meeting. In the depths of his heart he did not respect his mother and, though this he never acknowledged to himself, did not love her. But in accordance with the views of the set he lived in, and as a result of his education, he could not imagine himself treating her in any way but one altogether submissive and respectful.
The more submissive and respectful he was externally, the less he honoured and loved her in his heart. Chapter 18. Vronsky followed the guard to the carriage and had to stop at the entrance of the compartment to let a lady pass out. The trained insight of a society man enabled Vronsky with a single glance to decide that she belonged to the best society. He apologized for being in her way and was about to enter the carriage, but felt compelled to have another look at her, not because she was very beautiful, nor because of the elegance and modest grace of her whole figure, but because he saw in her sweet face as she passed him something specially tender and kind. When he looked round, she too turned her head. Her bright grey eyes, which seemed dark because of their black lashes, rested for a moment on his face as if recognizing him, and then turned to the passing crowd, evidently in search of someone. In that short look, Vronsky had time to notice the subdued animation that enlivened her face, and seemed to flutter between her bright eyes and a scarcely perceptible smile which curved her rosy lips. It was as if an excess of vitality so filled her whole being that it betrayed itself against her will, now in her smile, now in the light of her eyes. She deliberately tried to extinguish that light in her eyes, but it shone, despite of her, in her faint smile. Vronsky entered the carriage. His mother, a thin old woman with black eyes and curled hair, screwed up her eyes as she recognized her son, and her thin lips smiled slightly. She rose from the seat, and giving her handbag to her maid, held out her small, dry hand to her son. Then, lifting his head, which had been bent to kiss her hand, kissed him on his face.
"You had my telegram? You're well? That's a good thing."
"Have you had a good journey?"
asked her son, sitting down on the seat beside her and involuntarily listening to a woman's voice outside the door. He knew it was the voice of the lady he had met as he entered the carriage.
"All the same, I don't agree with you," the lady was saying.
"Yours are Petersburg views, madame."
"Oh, not at all. Simply a woman's views."
"Well, allow me to kiss your hand."
"Au revoir, Ivan Petrovich. And please, if you see my brother, send him to me," said the lady, closing the door and again entering the compartment.
"Well, have you found your brother?"
asked Vronsky's mother, addressing the lady.
Vronsky understood now that this was Mrs. Karenina. "Your brother is here," he said, rising. "Excuse my not recognizing you before. Our acquaintance was so slight," he said with a bow, "that I am sure you do not remember me."
"Oh, yes, I should have recognized you, especially as I believe your mother and I have talked of nothing but you all the way," said she, at last allowing the animation she had been trying to suppress to reveal itself in a smile.
"But my brother is not here yet."
"Go and call him, Alexei," said the old countess. Vronsky went out onto the platform and shouted,
"Oblonsky! Here!"
Mrs. Karenina did not wait for her brother to come in, but on seeing him descended from the carriage with a firm, light step. As soon as her brother came up to her, she threw her left arm round his neck with a movement that struck Vronsky by its firmness and grace, and drawing him to herself, gave him a vigorous kiss. Vronsky did not take his eyes off her, and kept smiling, he knew not why. But remembering that his mother was waiting for him, he went back into the carriage.
"She's very charming, isn't she?" said the Countess, referring to Mrs. Karenina. "Her husband put her into the compartment with me, and I was very pleased. We talked all the way. And you, I hear, vous filez le parfait amour? Tant mieux, mon cher, tant mieux."
"I don't know what you mean, maman," the son replied coldly.
"Well, shall we go?"
Mrs. Karenina again entered the carriage to take leave of the Countess. "There, Countess, you have met your son and I my brother," she said, "and I have exhausted my stock of stories and should have had nothing more to tell you.
"Oh, no, no," said the Countess, holding her hand. "I could travel round the world with you and not be dull. You are one of those charming women with whom it is nice to talk and nice to be silent. But please don't fret about your son. You can't expect never to be parted." Mrs. Karenina stood very erect, and her eyes were smiling. "Anna Arkadyevna Karenina has a son who, I think, is 8 years old," explained the Countess, "and she has never before been separated from him, and so she is worried at having left him." "Yes, the Countess and I have talked all the time, I about my son and she about hers," said Mrs. Karenina, and a smile brightened her face, a kind smile on his account. "I expect you got very weary of it," he said, quickly seizing in its flight the ball of coquetry she had thrown at him. But she evidently did not wish to continue the conversation in that tone, and turned to the old Countess. "Oh, thank you very much. I hardly noticed how the time passed. Au revoir, Countess." "Goodbye, dear," answered the Countess. "Let me kiss your pretty face. I'm an old woman, and say what I mean, and tell you frankly that I've lost my heart to you." Conventional as the phrase was, Mrs. Karenina evidently believed it and was pleased. She blushed, stooped a little, and held out her face for the Countess to kiss. Then she stood up again and, with the same smile hovering between her lips and eyes, held out her hand to Vronsky. He pressed the little hand, and the firm grip with which she shook his gave him unusual pleasure. She went out with that brisk tread which carried her rather full figure with such wonderful ease. "Very charming," said the old lady. Her son thought so too. He followed her with his eyes as long as he could see her graceful form, and his face retained its smile. Through the carriage window he saw her approach her brother and speak to him with animation about something that evidently had no connection with him, Vronsky, and that seemed to him provoking.
"Well, maman, are you quite well?" he said, turning toward his mother.
"Quite. Everything is all right. Alexander was very nice, and Varya looks very handsome. She is most interesting." And she began to tell about what interested her most, her grandson's christening, for which she had gone to Petersburg, and the special favour the emperor had shown to her eldest son.
"Here is Lavrenti at last," said Vronsky, looking out of the window. "We can go now, if you like."
The old majordomo, who had accompanied the Countess on her journey, came in and announced that everything was ready, and the Countess rose to go.
"Come, there's not much of a crowd now," said Vronsky.
The maid took one bag and the little dog, the majordomo and the porter took the other bags. Vronsky gave his arm to his mother, but just as they were coming out of the carriage, several people ran past them with frightened faces. The station master, with his peculiar coloured cap, also ran past them. Evidently something unusual had happened. The people were running back from the train.
"What? What? Where? Thrown himself under! Run over!" shouted the passers-by.
Oblonsky, with his sister on his arm, also turned back and, avoiding the crowd, stood with frightened faces beside the carriage. The ladies re-entered the carriage, while Vronsky and Oblonsky followed the crowd to find out about the accident. A watchman, either tipsy or too much muffled up because of the severe frost, had not heard a train that was being shunted and had been run over. Before Vronsky and Oblonsky returned, the ladies had heard this from the majordomo. Oblonsky and Vronsky had both seen the mangled corpse. Oblonsky was evidently suffering. His face was puckered, and he seemed ready to cry.
"Oh, how terrible! Oh, Anna, if you had seen it! Oh, how terrible!" he kept saying.
Vronsky remained silent. His handsome face was serious, but perfectly calm.
"Oh, if you had seen it, Countess," said Oblonsky. "And his wife was there. It was dreadful to see her. She threw herself on the body. They say he was the sole support of a very large family. It is terrible."
"Can nothing be done for her?" said Mrs. Karenina in an agitated whisper.
Vronsky glanced at her and at once went out. "I will be back directly, maman," he added, turning at the doorway. When he returned a few minutes later, Oblonsky was already talking to the Countess about the new opera singer, while she was impatiently glancing at the door in expectation of her son. "Now let's go," said Vronsky as he came in. They went together, Vronsky walking in front with his mother, Mrs. Karenina following with her brother. At the exit, the station master overtook them and said to Vronsky,
"You gave my assistant 200 rubles. Please be so kind as to say whom you intended it for."
"For the widow," said Vronsky, shrugging his shoulders. "I don't understand what need there is to ask."
"You have given it?" exclaimed Oblonsky behind Vronsky, and pressing his sister's arm, he added, "Very kind, very kind. Isn't he a fine fellow? My respects to you, Countess." And he remained behind with his sister, seeking her maid.
When they came out, the Vronsky's carriage had already started. The people coming from the station were still talking about the accident.
"What a terrible death," said some gentleman as he passed them. "Cut in half, I hear."
"On the contrary, I think it is a very easy death, instantaneous," said another.
"How is it that precautions are not taken?" said a third. Mrs. Karenina got into her brother's carriage, and Oblonsky noticed with surprise that her lips were trembling and that it was with difficulty she kept back her tears.
"What is the matter with you, Anna?" he asked when they had gone a few hundred yards.
"It's a bad omen," she replied.
"What nonsense!" said Oblonsky. "You're here, and that is the chief thing. You can't think how my hopes rest on you."
"And have you known Vronsky long?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Do you know we hope he will marry Kitty?"
"Yes," said Anna softly. "But let us talk about your affairs," she added, shaking her head, as if she wished physically to drive away something superfluous that hampered her. "Let us talk of your affairs. I've received your letter and have come."
"Yes, all my hopes are fixed on you," said her brother.
"Well, tell me all about it."
And Oblonsky began his story. On reaching his house, he helped his sister out of the carriage, pressed her hand, and drove off to his office. Chapter 19. When Anna arrived, Dolly was sitting in her little drawing room, giving a fair-haired, plump little boy, who already resembled his father, a French reading lesson. The boy, as he read, kept twisting and trying to pull off a loose button that hung from his jacket. His mother moved his plump little hand away several times, but it always returned to the button. At last she pulled the button off and put it into her pocket.
"Keep your hands quiet, Grisha," she said,
and again took up the rug she was knitting, a piece of work begun long ago to which she always returned in times of trouble, and which she was now knitting, nervously throwing the stitches over with her fingers and counting them. Though she had sent word to her husband the day before that she did not care whether his sister came or not, she had prepared everything for her visit and awaited her with agitation. Dolly was overpowered by her sorrow, and was quite absorbed by it. Nevertheless, she remembered that her sister-in-law, Anna, was the wife of one of the most important men in Petersburg, and a grande dame. Thanks to that circumstance, she did not carry out her threat to her husband and did not forget that her sister-in-law was coming. "After all, it is not in the least Anna's fault," thought she. "I know nothing but good about her, and she has never shown me anything but kindness and friendship." It was true that, as far as she could remember her visit to the Karenins in Petersburg, she had not liked their house. There seemed to be something false in the tone of their family life. "But why should I not receive her? If only she does not try to console me," thought Dolly,
All these consolations and exhortations and Christian forgiveness, I have considered them 1,000 times, and they are all no good. All these last days, Dolly had been alone with her children. She did not wish to talk about her sorrow, yet with that on her mind, she could not talk about indifferent matters. She knew that one way or other she would tell Anna everything, and now it pleased her to think how she would say it, and then she felt vexed to have to speak of her humiliation to her, his sister, and to hear from her set phrases of exhortation and consolation. As it often happens, though she kept looking at the clock, waiting for Anna, she let the moment when her visitor arrived go by without even hearing the bell. And when she heard soft steps and the rustle of petticoats already in the doorway, she looked round with an expression not of pleasure but of surprise on her careworn face. She rose and embraced her sister-in-law. "So you're here already," she said, kissing her. "Dolly, I am so pleased to see you." "And I am pleased too," said Dolly with a feeble smile, trying to guess from Anna's expression how much she knew. "She must know," she thought, noticing the look of sympathy on Anna's face. "Come, let me take you to your room," she went on, trying to put off as long as possible the moment for explanation.
"This is Grisha? Dear me, how he has grown," said Anna,
and having kissed him, she stood with her eyes fixed on Dolly and blushed. "No, please, do not let us go anywhere." She took off her shawl and her hat, and having caught it in her black and very curly hair, shook her head to disengage it. "And you are radiant with joy and health," said Dolly, almost enviously.
"I?"
"Yes," said Anna.
"Why, dear me, here is Tanya. You're just the same age as my little Seretsa," she added, turning to the little girl who had run into the room,
and, taking her in her arms, Anna kissed her.
"Sweet girlie, darling! Oh, let me see them all."
She not only mentioned them all by name, but remembered the years and even the months of their births, their characters, and what illnesses they had had, and Dolly could not help appreciating this.
"Shall we go and see them?" she said.
"It is a pity Vasya is asleep." Having looked at the children, they returned to the drawing-room and, being now alone, sat down to coffee at the table. Anna took hold of the tray, but then pushed it aside.
"Dolly," she said, "he has told me."
Dolly looked coldly at Anna. She expected now to hear words of insincere sympathy, but Anna said nothing of the kind. "Dolly, dear," she began, "I do not wish to take his part or console you. That would be impossible, but, dearest, I'm simply sorry for you. Sorry from the bottom of my heart." Her bright eyes under their thick lashes suddenly filled with tears. She moved closer to her sister-in-law and with her energetic little hand took hold of Dolly's. The latter did not draw back from her, but her face retained its rigid expression. She said, "It is impossible to console me. Everything is lost after what has happened. Everything destroyed." As soon as she had said it, her face softened. Anna lifted Dolly's dry, thin hand, kissed it, and said, "But what is to be done, Dolly? What is to be done? What is the best way of acting in this dreadful position? That is what one has to consider."
"Everything is at an end, and that's all," said Dolly. "And the worst of it is, you understand, that I can't leave him. There are the children, and I am bound. Yet I can't live with him. It is torture for me to see him."
"Dolly, my darling, he has spoken to me, but I want to hear it from you. Tell me everything." Dolly looked at her inquiringly. Sincere sympathy and affection were visible in Anna's face.
"If you like," said Dolly, suddenly. "But I'll begin from the beginning. You know how I was married. With the education Mama gave me, I was not merely naive, but silly. I knew nothing. I know they say husbands tell their wives how they have lived, but Steva..." She corrected herself. "But Stepan Arkadyevich never told me anything. You'll hardly believe it, but up to now I thought I was the only woman he'd ever known. In this way I lived for 9 years. Only think that I not only did not suspect him of unfaithfulness, but thought it impossible. I then... just imagine, with such ideas, suddenly to find out all the horrors, all the abomination. Try to understand me, to be fully convinced of one's happiness, and suddenly..." continued Dolly, suppressing her sobs, "to read a letter. His letter to his mistress, my children's governess? Oh, no, it is too horrible." She suddenly drew out her handkerchief and hid her face in it. "I could perhaps understand a momentary slip," she went on after a pause. "Deliberately, cunningly, to deceive me. And with whom? To go on living with me as my husband and with her at the same time? It's awful! You cannot realize..." "Oh, yes, I do. I do understand, Dolly, dear, I do understand," said Anna, pressing her hand. "And do you think he realizes the horror of my situation?" continued Dolly. "Not at all. He is happy and contented." "Oh, no," Anna quickly interrupted. "He is pitiable. He is overwhelmed with remorse." "Is he capable of remorse?" interrupted Dolly, looking searchingly into her sister-in-law's face. "Oh, yes. I know him. I could not look at him without pity. We both know him. He's kind-hearted, but... he's proud, too, and now he is so humiliated. What moved me most is..." And here Anna guessed what would touch Dolly most. "That two things tormented him. He is ashamed of the children, and that loving you..." "Yes, yes, loving you more than anything else in the world," she hurriedly went on, not listening to Dolly, who was about to reply. "He has hurt you. Hit you so hard. He kept saying, 'No, no, she will not forgive me.'" Dolly, gazing beyond her sister-in-law, listened thoughtfully. "Yes, I understand that his position is dreadful."
"It is worse for the guilty than for the innocent one," she said. "If he feels that the misfortune all comes from his fault..."
"But how can I forgive him? How can I be a wife to him after her? Life with him now will be a torture for me, just because I love my old love for him."
Sobs cut short her words. But as if intentionally, every time she softened, she again began to speak of the thing that irritated her.
"You know, she is young, she's pretty," she said. "You see, Anna, my youth and my good looks have been sacrificed. And to whom? For him and his children. I have served his purpose and lost all I had in the service. And, of course, a fresh, good-for-nothing creature now pleases him better. They probably talked about me, or, worse still, avoided the subject. You understand?"
And hatred again burned in her eyes.
"And after that he will tell me... am I to believe him? Never. No, it's all ended. All that served as a consolation, as a reward for my labours, my sufferings,
Will you believe me? I have just been teaching Grisha. It used to be a pleasure, and now it is a torment. What is the good of my taking pains, of working so hard? What use are the children? It is terrible. My soul has so revolted that instead of love and tenderness for him, I have nothing but anger left. Yes, anger. I could kill him.
Dolly, dearest, I understand, but don't torture yourself. You are so deeply hurt, so upset that you see many things in the wrong light.
Dolly was silent, and for a moment or two neither spoke.
What am I to do? Think it over, Anna. Help me. I have turned over in my mind everything I could think of and can find nothing.
Anna could not think of anything, but her heart responded to every word and every look of Dolly's. All I can say is, began Anna, I am his sister, and I know his character, his capacity for forgetting everything. She made a gesture with her hand in front of her forehead. That capacity for letting himself be completely carried away, but on the other hand, for completely repenting. He can hardly believe now, or can hardly understand, how he could do it.
No, he understands and understood, Dolly interrupted. And I? You forget me. Does this make it easier for me?
Wait a bit. When he was speaking to me, I confess I did not quite realize the misery of your position. I saw only his side, and that the family was upset, and I was sorry for him. But now, having spoken with you, I, as a woman, see something else. I see your suffering, and I cannot tell you how sorry I am for you, but, Dolly, dearest, I fully understand your sufferings, yet there is one thing I do not know. I do not know how much love there still is in your soul. You alone know that. Is there enough for forgiveness? If there is, then forgive him.
No,
Dolly began, but Anna stopped her and again kissed her hand. I know the world better than you do, she said. I know men like Stiva and how they see these things. You think he spoke to her about you? That never happens. These men may be unfaithful, but their homes, their wives, are their holy places. They manage in some way to hold these women in contempt and don't let them interfere with the family. They seem to draw some kind of line between the family and those others. I do not understand it, but it is so.
Yes, but he kissed her.
Dolly, wait a bit. I have seen Steve when he was in love with you. I remember his coming to me and weeping. What poetry and high ideals you were bound up with in his mind. And I know the longer he lived with you, the higher you rose in his esteem. You know, we used to laugh at him because his every third word was, Dolly is a wonderful woman. You have been and still are his divinity. And this infatuation never reached his soul. But suppose the infatuation is repeated? It cannot be, as I understand. And you? Would you forgive? I do not know. I cannot judge. Yes, I can, said Anna, after a minute's consideration. Her mind had taken in and weighed the situation, and she added, Yes, I can. I can. Yes, I should forgive. I should not remain the same woman. No, but I should forgive. And forgive it as utterly as if it had never happened at all.
Well, of course,
Dolly put in quickly, as if saying what she had often herself thought, or else it would not be forgiveness.
If one is to forgive, it must be entire forgiveness.
Well, now, I will
show you your room."
She rose, and on the way embraced Anna. "My dear, how glad I am you came. I feel better now. Much better."
Chapter 20. The whole of that day Anna remained at home, that is, at the Oblonskys' house, and did not receive anybody, although several of her acquaintances who had heard of her arrival came to see her. She spent the earlier part of the day with Dolly and the children, and sent a note to her brother to be sure and come home to dinner. "Come," she wrote, "God is merciful." Oblonsky dined at home. The conversation was general, and his wife addressed him familiarly in the second person singular, which she had not done all these days. There was still the same estrangement in their manner to each other, but no longer any question of separating, and Oblonsky saw that explanation and reconciliation were possible. Immediately after dinner, Kitty came. She knew Anna, but only slightly, and came to her sister's not without fear of how she might be received by this Petersburg society woman whom everybody admired so much. But she noticed at once that Anna liked her. It was evident that her beauty and youth gave Anna pleasure, and before Kitty had time to regain her self-possession, she felt not only that she was under Anna's influence, but that she was in love with her, as young girls often are with married women older than themselves. Anna was not like a society woman or the mother of an 8-year-old son. The flexibility of her figure, her freshness, and the natural animation of her face appearing now in her smile, now in her eyes, would have made her look more like a girl of 20 had it not been for a serious and sometimes even sad expression in her eyes which struck Kitty and attracted her. Kitty felt that Anna was perfectly unaffected and was not trying to conceal anything, but that she lived in another, higher world full of complex, poetic interests beyond Kitty's reach. After dinner, when Dolly had gone to her own room, Anna got up quickly and went to her brother, who was just lighting a cigar. "Steva," she said to him, with a merry twinkle in her eye, and making the sign of the cross over him as she indicated the door with a look. "Go, and may God help you." He understood, threw down his cigar, and disappeared through the door. When Oblonsky had gone, she returned to the sofa where she had been sitting, surrounded by the children. Whether because they saw that Mama was fond of this aunt, or because they themselves felt her peculiar charm, first the two older children, and then the younger ones, as is often the way with children, had even before dinner begun clinging to her, and now would not leave her side. And they started something like a game, which consisted in trying to get as close to her as possible, to touch her, hold her little hand, kiss her, play with her ring, or at least touch the frills of her dress. "Now, how were we sitting before?" said Anna, resuming her seat. And Grisha again pushed his head under her arm, and leaning against her dress, beamed with pride and joy. "And when is the ball to be?" said Anna, turning to Kitty. "Next week, and it will be a delightful ball, one of those balls which are always jolly." "Are there any that are always jolly?" asked Anna, with tender irony. "It is strange, but there are. It's always jolly at the Bobrishovs and also at the Nikitins, while it's always dull at the Metzkovs. Haven't you noticed it?" "No, my dear, there are no more jolly balls for me," said Anna. And Kitty saw in her eyes that peculiar world which was not yet revealed to her. "There are some that are not as difficult and dull as the rest." "How can you be dull at a ball?" "Why cannot I be dull at a ball?" asked Anna. Kitty saw that Anna knew the answer that would follow. "Because you must always be the belle of the ball." Anna had a capacity for blushing. She blushed and answered, "In the first place, I never am. But even if I were, what use would it be to me?" "Will you go to that ball?" asked Kitty. "I suppose I shall have to. Here, take this."
she said, turning to Tanya, who was drawing off a ring which fitted loosely on her aunt's small, tapering finger. "I shall be very glad if you go. I should so like to see you at a ball." "Well, then, if I have to go, I shall console myself with the reflection that it will give you pleasure." "Oh, Grisha, please, don't pull so hard. It's all in a tangle already," she said, arranging a loose lock of hair with which Grisha was playing. "I imagine you at that ball in lilac."
"Why must it be lilac?"
asked Anna, half laughing. "Now, children, run away, run away. Don't you hear? There's Miss Hull calling you to tea," she went on, disengaging herself from the children and dispatching them to the dining room. "But I know why you are asking me to go to that ball. You're expecting much from it and would like everybody to be there and have a share in it."
"How do you know?"
"Well, yes."
"Oh, yes, it is good to be your age," Anna continued.
"I remember and know that blue mist, like the mist on the Swiss mountains. That mist which envelops everything at that blissful time when childhood is just coming to an end and its immense blissful circle turns into an ever-narrowing path. And you enter the defile gladly, yet with dread, though it seems bright and beautiful. Who has not passed through it?" Kitty smiled and remained silent. How did she pass through it? How I should like to know her story, thought she, recollecting the unpoetic appearance of Anna's husband, Alexei Karenin. "I know something. Stiva told me, and I congratulate you." "I like him very much," Anna continued. "I met Vronsky at the railway station."
"Oh, was he there?" asked Kitty, blushing.
"What did Stiva tell you?"
"Stiva let it all out to me, and I shall be very pleased. I travelled yesterday with Vronsky's mother," she continued. "And she talked about him all the time. He's her favourite son. I know how partial mothers are, but what did his mother tell you?"
"Oh, very much. And I know he is her favourite, but anyone can see he is full of chivalry. For instance, she told me that he wished to give all his property to his brother, that already, as a boy, he had done something extraordinary, saved a woman from drowning. In a word, he is a hero," said Anna, smiling, and remembering the 200 rubles he had given away at the station. But she did not mention the 200 rubles. For some reason, she did not like to think of them. She felt that there had been something in it relating personally to her that should not have been. "She particularly wished me to go and see her," continued Anna. "I shall be glad to see the old lady again, and we'll go tomorrow." "Well, thank heaven Stiva is stopping a long time with Dolly," she added, changing the subject. And she rose, dissatisfied with something, Kitty thought.
"I was first! No, I!" cried the children, who, having finished their tea, rushed back to Aunt Anna.
"All together!" said Anna, laughing and running to meet them, and putting her arms round them, she tumbled the whole heap of children, struggling and shrieking joyfully, onto the floor.
Chapter 21 Dolly came out of her room for the grown-up people's tea. Oblonsky did not appear. He'd probably left his wife's room by the other door.
"I'm afraid you'll be cold upstairs," remarked Dolly to Anna. "I want to move you down, and then we shall be nearer to one another."
"Oh, please don't trouble about me," said Anna, scrutinising Dolly's face and trying to discover whether a reconciliation had taken place.
"It'll be too light for you downstairs," said her sister-in-law.